Thank you very much, Ambassador Galbraith, for that very illuminating discussion. And if you will now return to the podium, you can easily look over my shoulder while I read these questions. There are two which are similar, and I will read them both. Is there any realistic alternative to artificial birth control in India? And has India's birth control problem shown any significant results as yet?
Well, I've said many times that a population policy, something which keeps a steadily increasing population from nullifying the gains of economic development, is, in my view, an indispensable part of the of a fully rounded development policy, not only in India but in other similarly situated countries. The as to the results that are being achieved, it's awfully hard to say. In the south of India, in the state of Madras, for example, there has been a very large system of clinics set up. Strong birth control program has been put into effect. Whether this can still be seen in its effect on the birth rate is hard to say. The statistics have lots of lags in them, and they're very hard to pin down. And what's being done, for example, in the city of Madras may well be offset by what isn't being done out in the villages. So I would be hesitant to answer that question. I would say that the organization of an effective population program is a most formidable thing. I might say I just seen that my plane is an hour late, so I can be slightly less breathless if you'll permit me. One of the things that we should keep in mind is that we have done far more in the last 15 years to increase the birth rate than we have yet done to limit it. One of the marvelously efficient health programs of the last 15 years has been the control of malaria. And the effect of malaria on fertility is just astonishing. You relieve them. When the fever stops, the children start coming. So that the effect of modern science so far has been infinitely more to increase the birth rate as well as to lowering infant mortality than it has been to restrict it.
Now, we have two companion questions which your experience in India would not enable you to answer, but your experience as an economist might. Is not Israel an exception to your statement that collectivized agriculture does not work effectively? And what is your opinion concerning the cooperative agricultural system adopted in Palestine, now Israel, 60 years ago, and would this land reform solution be instrumental in solving the problems in undeveloped and semi-developed countries?
I think actually this is a very good question. I think that Israel is an exception. And I think it would be a disaster if the world were to assume that what works in Israel will work anywhere else. This was a highly literate, highly educated population of the most extreme motivation. And they went out to the desert to make the cooperatives work, to make the kibbutzi work, and they did. I doubt that there is another population in the world where one could hope that this would be a workable solution. And I would even point out to the militant Zionist who asked that question the trend in Israel in the last few years has been strongly away from the cooperatives. The generation that made the cooperatives work is being replaced by a even in Israel by a somewhat more individualistic generation, which is not reacting to cooperative agriculture with anything like the same enthusiasm.
And now we have this. Henry Kissinger's book, The Necessity for Choice, states that Marxism is a more efficient form of government for a rising nation which has had little or no experience with democratic forms of government and which is trying to become industrialized. How do you feel about this premise?
Well, Henry is a very good friend of mine. I think he's also wrong in this particular point. The problem of organizing an effective government which makes use of what I have, as I say for brevity, called Western forms is not by any means easy. But the problem of finding the administrative talent which will do the much more comprehensive job of organization that is associated with socialism, Marxian socialism, is much more difficult. And indeed, I would go so far as to say that this is another way of making the point that I made on agriculture, that the resources in organization do not exist to make farmers do on a large scale what they don't want to do, peasant farmers, and that this, therefore, is the limiting factor on applying Marxian techniques particularly to agriculture. Problem with industry is easier. There's no question about it. Problem of organizing industry is much easier than the problem of organizing agriculture. One has to bear in mind that the underdeveloped country is an agricultural country. If it has a large amount of industry, it's no longer an underdeveloped country.
Now, this questioner has left it open for you to answer no, if you choose. Would you comment on the present situation in Kashmir?
Well, this is a question that I'll gladly turn over to my distinguished colleague here from Pakistan and my distinguished colleague from India. And let them have the bilateral conversations, which have been something of a point of which we have to some extent been urging. I think maybe I should not launch into this matter beyond saying that it's a very troublesome problem and that I had hoped not to have to be involved in it for another 10 days.
Here's a gentleman who has read your book. Will affluence of the communist society have the same unfortunate effects that you have noted in our society?
Well, I didn't describe them as unfortunate, did I?
No, that's his description.
I've always taken it as a point of some slight pride that I've had a favorable effect on the affluent society, particularly on automobile design. The preoccupation with the amenities of life is peculiar to capitalism, and I think it's a terrible mistake. And that the Soviets have, or all societies, have yearnings for the things which we have found so convenient and comfortable is something I think we can put down as fact. And I suppose this carries all the way from the yearning for motor scooters, automobiles, transistor radios, up to the desire to listen to Benny Goodman on Red Square. And that this has a mellowing impact on people's political reactions. I have no doubt whatever that that there is a certain political desperate that a certain political desperation that is born of poverty is I'm certain, one of the things that we may assume. So that affluence has represents one step toward accommodation, something I'm quite prepared to argue.
Here is another gentleman who has read some of your published works. 20 years ago, you wrote and established a certain philosophy of economic development. With the passage of time, has that position been altered or modified?
Oh, Lord, yes. I've never seen any. I've never seen any virtue in the closed mind. And I must say, one of the things that disturbs me about the this enormous upsurge of enthusiasm for paperback books is the number of one's old books that get republished. And and into the bookstores. And I'll be prepared on some future occasion to give you a list of those of mine that I would strongly urge you not to read. On economic development as such, let me just say one word. I have become increasingly impressed of the importance of education, of the improvement of human beings and their capacities, as compared and in contrast with investment in physical plant. I don't for a moment deny the importance of that. But in the system of priorities, I'm much more persuaded than I was 20 years ago or 10 years ago of the importance of beginning with the resources that you have to develop the basic requirements of literacy and the accessibility to the human mind that education provides. And when I say that, I say it with a certain discomfort, because it was something that we once knew. I mean, in the 19th century, we took for granted that the first thing a developing country should do is get a school system. And after that came the heavy furniture of the Industrial Revolution. And I think that in rediscovering this particular fact, I'm merely saying something which my great-grandfather would have taken for granted.
We have time for just one more question, and I have a large one here. I think probably the president will be glad to get the answer. Can President Kennedy's anti-inflation policy prevent further inflation?
Yes, I would think so. I think that probably the growing confidence that this is so has had something to do with the movements in the stock market in the last few weeks. If there's a growing confidence that inflation will not continue inevitably, then there's a somewhat lesser need to hold common stocks as an inflation hedge, and there's, of course, a somewhat lesser prospect of capital gains forever and ever. And I'll tell you why I think this. There have been two economic views on this subject, as you all know. I'm sure you've heard them debated ad nauseum in this particular room. The view which is held that the problem of inflation is essentially the problem of the pressure of demand on the economy, the pull of demand. And the view that has held that the problem lies in the relation between costs and prices. I have always strongly held to the second view, that the cost-price spiral, wage-price spiral, is the essential dynamism, has the essential thrust, is the essential dynamism or the essential thrust to inflation. And I have also held a further, somewhat less orthodox view that less common view, that one of the reasons that this was so dangerous was that we never really came to grips with the problem. That if we actually, the government worked seriously with management and seriously with labor, with a framework of standards before both, that it wouldn't be as difficult to get this under a system of effective restraints as we had imagined. And that proof of the point was that Germany, France, significantly the Netherlands, had made enormous progress in doing so without any great modification of institutions, without any great new arrangements, merely as a cooperative relationship between with the corporations and the unions within a framework of what could be afforded. And that were we to make the same effort, we wouldn't be less successful. As I say, this has long been my view, and I think it's a very good chance that now the effort is being made that it will be successful, that prices are going to be flat, stable for the rest of my life, the rest of yours, I wouldn't hold for a moment, but a government energetically addressing itself to the problem of inflation and seeing it in these terms can succeed is something I strongly believe.
Mr. Ambassador, we are very grateful to you for giving us your time and this instructive address and the very instructive answers to the questions, and we are glad that you don't have to rush for your plane.